From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our program on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Guy Raz. This episode, taxes, who pays, who doesn't, and what's fair or not. With tax day approaching, you may be hearing things like this.
When 50% of Americans do not pay any kind of federal income tax, that's wrong. They should pay something.
But is that really true? Also, writer Daniel Mendelsohn follows in the steps of Odysseus and imagine finding this piece of paper.
And I looked down at the corner and there was a signature P. Revere Sculp.
A rare engraving hidden deep inside a library. Plus, we check in with our three-minute fiction judge, Luis Alberto Urrea. The story of Carl Wallinger, the 1990s modern rock darling from World Party, on the day he almost died. And the music of Cuban jazz sensation Alfredo Rodriguez. That's all on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. Happy Tax Week.
Now, we don't want the really poor people who are in poverty to have to pay income taxes. But 51% of all households?
Now, around tax time, there's a good chance you hear about Americans who don't pay taxes. That was the voice of Utah Senator Orrin Hatch. And here's House Majority Leader Eric Cantor.
But we also have a situation in this country where you're nearing 50% of people who don't even pay income taxes.
Yeah, that's the shared side.
You'll hear it on cable news and talk radio.
47% of Americans not paying taxes. 47%.
47%! Of Americans do not pay.
47% of families pay no taxes. That's a very, very bad warning sign for what's coming in this country.
It is true that about half of American households pay no federal income tax, but half of the American population paying no taxes, none at all? That's not true. There are sales taxes and payroll taxes and state taxes and more. Our cover story today, taxes, who pays, who doesn't, what's fair and what isn't. In a moment, why being classified by the government as rich is a curse for one family. But first, given all the attention paid to those people who supposedly don't pay anything, we went out to search for one. For starters, we figured, if you paid no taxes, you'd have to live in a state with, at the very least, no sales tax. There are five of them: Alaska, Oregon, New Hampshire, Delaware, and Montana, where we cold-called some accountants, until someone suggested we call John Steinhoff in Great Falls.
JCCS, this is John.
Hey, John, it's Guy Raz here at NPR. Happy
yes,
tax
sir.
Week. Happy tax week to you.
You too.
I know you're busy. I explained that we were looking for someone who could legally live paying virtually no taxes. John Steinhoff told us it wouldn't be impossible.
In the state of Montana, basically you'd have to be unemployed, so no earned wages. You don't own any real property. You wouldn't pay any sin tax, so no liquor, tobacco, anything like that. And the state of Montana doesn't have a sales tax, so you could still buy food and supplies and not pay tax.
That sounds all right. So do you know where we could find somebody like that?
You know, I've heard of places like Lincoln, for example, where Ted Kaczynski lived.
Oh.
You know, he
wasn't paying taxes.
Lived off the grid.
Yeah.
And then there's some places I've heard of up in northwest Montana where there are individuals.
So we called around northwest Montana for a while until we finally found a woman named Lisa Block.
This is Lisa. Can I help you?
Lisa lives in an area of the Kootenay National Forest. Do you pay any property tax, for example?
Property tax, no.
That's because she and her husband live on land her father-in-law owns. What about municipality taxes? Do you have to pay any of those?
No. We live out in the country.
So no trash collection or that sort of thing?
No.
They take their trash to the dump themselves. Federal income tax, do you have to pay any of that?
No.
She doesn't earn enough income to qualify. She makes a modest living running a sewing shop out of the house. What about groceries and stuff? Is that where a big part of your money goes?
No, actually, my husband and I, we both hunt. Deer, elk,
yeah.
Preferably, antelope. We raise our own beef, pork, and chickens. And we put in a garden every year.
But it turns out, even in one of the remotest parts of America, Lisa still pays taxes, gasoline taxes for the truck, and a state self-employment tax.
It was looking the other night about, my self-employment tax is probably going to only be about $300.
It's not a lot, but it's also not nothing. So, who does pay a lot? Let's call them the 10 percenters.
Hi, Jenny.
Good. Okay, talked with you the other day.
So
yep.
Nice to meet
Come on
you.
In.
The top 10% of income earners in America pay 70% of all federal income taxes. People like Jim and Janet Bortscheller, who our producer Brent Bachman visited in Fairfax, Virginia this week, they are in the top 10% of income earners in America.
How much disposable income do you have at the end of the month after all the bills are paid?
Like zero. Oh, not very much.
That, of course, is Janet. Her husband, Jim, is a defense contractor and is now the family's sole breadwinner. And why is he in the top 10%? Because he earns about $110,000 a year. Once your household income exceeds $110,000, you are considered rich by the U.S. government, the top 10%. But in each of the past 2 years, the Bortschellers have had to dip into their IRA account or savings just to pay their tax bill.
We do hear, you know, I guess we're top 10%. I mean, if we're having trouble making it, I wonder how many other people are.
The Bortschellers have put three kids through college. Two of them live at home, but between their mortgage and college loans, gas and utilities, they aren't left with a whole lot. And then there's their eldest son. When he was 11, that son developed a tumor around his brainstem. It's benign. He still has it and lives a relatively normal life, but his medical bills are a huge expense. Here's Jim.
I don't expect Uncle Sam to pay for a lot of this stuff, any of this stuff. We're doing that, but ambition is good. Wanting to improve yourself is good. And when the government takes away from those who are working hard to try and improve their lot, to give it to those who don't do work hard, don't work at all, that's wrong. This notion of...
As far as the Bortschellers go, they pay a much higher percentage of their income in tax than either President Obama or Mitt Romney, or most millionaires, for that matter.
It may sound like a lot, 10%, 70% of income tax, but the top 10% receive over 40% of the income.
That's Joel Slemrod, a professor of economics at the University of Michigan.
And most of us think it's appropriate that the fraction of income that's owed in tax is higher for higher-income people.
Slemrod says the top 10% of income earners, like Jim and Janet Bortscheller, pay 70% of income taxes because the tax code is supposed to work in a pretty straightforward way.
So that a millionaire not only would owe more tax than somebody who earned $50,000, but they would owe more as a percentage of their income than the person who earned $50,000.
Well, our current system doesn't work that way in many ways, as you know. I mean, explain this to us. President Obama earned more than $750,000 last year. He is paying an effective tax rate of 20.5%. Mitt Romney earned millions. He is going to be paying 15%. Most people listening to us, probably you and me certainly, we are paying much higher rates, 25, 30, 35. And on, when you factor state taxes and municipal taxes, even higher in some cases.
Yes. And so it may seem like a contradiction with the fact that the income tax rate structure is graduated and progressive. The reason we see Mitt Romney and people like that owing a lower fraction of their income in tax is mostly due to the fact that he and, on average, other very high-income people get a lot of their income in the form of either dividends from corporations or capital gains on the sale of appreciated assets. And since 2003, both capital gains and dividends have been subject to a preferentially lower tax rate, at most 15%. That's the reason that people like Mitt Romney often have a lower average tax rate than somebody who earns, say, $50,000 or $250,000 in a year.
As you know, there's a debate in Washington about whether to cut, whether to raise taxes, whether to do a combination of both or neither. Or if, say, the government said we want to solve our deficit problem, our debt problems, only through taxation, how much would each American have to pay to support, you know, the current level of federal spending?
Yeah, if you look at just the deficits we're facing in this decade, so let's say we wanted to get deficits down to just 2% of GDP, all the rates would have to go up by about half. So the 10% rate would have to be 15. The top rate of 35 would have to be about 52%. And that's only looking at this decade. As you know, looking out many decades ahead, we face a very large fiscal imbalance due to the promises made through Social Security and especially Medicare. We're tens of trillions of dollars short, and most economists think that we have to deal with that sooner rather than later, and increased taxes probably should be part of the solution.
Joel Slemrod at the University of Michigan. Before we go, a little perspective here from Eduardo Porter, who writes about economics for the New York Times. Eduardo Porter, happy tax week to you.
Happy tax week.
I'm sure you're as happy as I am. So here's Eduardo Porter with a list of countries that collect more taxes relative to their overall economy than the U.S. does. The U.S. collects the equivalent of a quarter of its GDP through taxes. Countries at the top of that list, it's closer to half.
Well, it starts with Denmark, then Sweden, third France, next Belgium.
Compared to a lot of these countries, Porter argues, the U.S. tax system is the most Byzantine, arcane system in the developed world.
Spain, Israel, Germany, the United Kingdom.
We use a system of taxation that requires a bunch of different tax rates with a bunch of different exceptions. Each of these differences, right, from one rate to another, one exception or another exception, induces changes in our behavior. You do something to avoid a tax or to get an exception or to get an exclusion. So this changes your desire to buy a house, your desire to work, your desire to invest. And all these behavioral changes ultimately act as a drag on the economy.
Which makes it harder to collect a lot of tax revenue. A more efficient system, Porter argues,
Portugal, Greece, Estonia,
is
Ireland,
the system
Australia,
used in a lot of countries on that list, a value-added tax. It's a federal tax on everything you buy. And it's an idea popular with a lot of economists, Eduardo Porter says, because it would collect more revenue from more people.
States that have a much flatter tax structure, where, say, the poor and the middle class pay much more in taxes as a share of their incomes, they tend to have systems of public finance, of government, that are much better at reducing inequality, at addressing, you know, the needs of the middle class and the poor than ours does, because they raise much more money.
The last time an American politician proposed this idea was actually in 1979. It was Oregon Congressman Al Ullman who called for a 10% national sales tax. And the next year, Al Ullman lost his bid for re-election. Writer Daniel Mendelsohn is a literary scholar, but he writes about all sorts of things. He teaches at Bard College in New York, and he's devoted most of his life to studying the classics. And a few years ago, Mendelsohn was teaching Homer's classic, The Odyssey, when his elderly father, Jay, a retired research scientist, decided to take his class. He wanted to understand his son better and to understand his life's work.
I think the students were very tickled by the fact that for once there was someone in the classroom who had more authority than the professor by dint of the fact that he was father. So he liked to contradict me a lot.
After the course was over, Daniel's father said he wanted to see the sights that Odysseus saw.
And so I called my dad and I said, you know, instead of us individually going to these various places which are associated with the voyage of Odysseus, what if we got on this small boat and just followed in the footsteps of Odysseus? So we signed on and off we went.
This is one of these sort of cruise companies that has lectures by academics and archaeologists. Mm-hmm. And in fact, you had been a lecturer on this cruise boat about 10 years ago, but you came on as a complete civilian, totally anonymous, and it was 10 days retracing the Odyssey, which took, of course, 10 years.
Yeah, one day per year, exactly.
The journey began in the city of Troy, ancient city of Troy. It's in modern-day Turkey. And you make an interesting observation, which is that this has actually been a tourist attraction since the time of Xerxes, since 480 BC. I mean, Alexander the Great visited there. Mm-hmm. People have been going there as tourists for thousands of years.
Right. I mean, one certainly gets a sense of the cultural power and authority of the Homeric poems, both the Iliad and the Odyssey, from the fact that already in antiquity it was a tourist destination to go to Troy, you know, and Alexander the Great went there. All kinds of people went there.
He slept with a copy of the Iliad under his pillow, you write.
Yes, yes. Also a dagger, apparently, because every Macedonian king had been assassinated for three generations. I like to think he got more out of the Iliad, but...
Back on the cruise, at certain points you stop off to see these sites of antiquity. A lot of speculation about whether they are really the place where these things happened. And at a certain point, your dad is looking at one of these sites and just sort of says, you know, this is just kitschy. This is not really where it happened.
Right, right. I've been many times to Greece and in the Mediterranean as a classicist, as a travel writer, but he hadn't. And so even the phony ones, you know, he got a big kick out of.
One of the amazing things about this trip was that there were about 80 passengers, you write. It's a small, a relatively small boat. And you talk about a passenger you met. You were sunbathing and you noticed a scar on his leg. And you didn't ask any questions, but he saw you looking at it. And then he explained what it was about.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, when you study the Odyssey, one of the key moments in the Odyssey is when Odysseus makes it back to Ithaca, but he's in disguise because he's going to make his way by stealth back into his palace and slay all the suitors who have been courting his wife for 20 years. And there's a moment where he's given a bath. He actually gets to the palace, and he's given a bath, still in disguise, by an ancient crone who has been part of the household. We learn in this extraordinary scene that as a youth, he had received a terrible wound during a boar hunt that left a scar on his leg. The nurse recognizes the scar, and she knows it's Odysseus. Mm. And he sort of shuts her up because he doesn't want his identity to be revealed. But it's a very crucial passage in the poem's sort of ongoing engagement with the question of identity and how you know who people are. And so I'm on this cruise and I'm on the deck and I noticed this Dutch guy, and he told me this extraordinary story that during World War II, when the Dutch were starving during this terrible winter and eating tulip bulbs to stay alive, he had been a teenager. He had injured himself trying to chop firewood. He was so weak and so malnourished that he had actually swung this axe and hit his own leg instead of the wood. And he almost died because he was so malnourished, and he was on a bed, delirious for weeks. And a family friend who was a classicist helped him get through this illness, in part by reading the Odyssey to him and other classical texts. And even though he wasn't a classic student, he recited to me on the deck of this ship as an elderly man lines from the Odyssey in Greek, which he had learned during this recuperation.
He told you that he made a vow that before he died, he would see what Odysseus saw. That's why he was on that cruise.
Right, and so that's why he was on the Odyssey cruise, and it's just amazing.
Unlike Odysseus, you never made it to Ithaca. There was
no.
a strike at the port, so the boat never arrived. But you write that in some ways it would have been almost anticlimactic to make it there.
Yeah, it was very funny because the last stop on the cruise was supposed to be Ithaca, of course. You know, you're following in the footsteps of Odysseus. That's where you end up. And so people by that point, because it was the end of the cruise, knew that I was working on this book and they knew that I was a writer. And they came up to me to commiserate and say, oh, how terrible, you don't have the end of your article. And I said, are you kidding? I couldn't even write an ending as good as the ending that fate has given me, because this way Ithaca just remains the infinitely receding horizon. And of course, the Odyssey is a poem about someone who loves to keep traveling. So I thought, that's perfect.
Daniel, I read this article just a few days ago and wanted to speak with you about it, only to learn that last week your father passed away.
My dad had a stroke in January, and he struggled as much as any Greek hero ever struggled to make a comeback. But in the end, it was too much for him, and he died last Friday, April 6th. And so now I can't travel with him anymore, but, you know, in a lot of ways he will stay with me during the remaining trips that I'm making and the readings that I'll be offering of these texts. And it just became a different kind of odyssey.
Well, Daniel Mendelsohn, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's writer Daniel Mendelsohn. The story of his Mediterranean tour, where he retraced the journey of Odysseus with his father, is in the latest issue of Travel and Leisure magazine. His new essay collection, Waiting for the Barbarians, Essays from the Classics to Pop Culture, will be published in August.
The British are coming! The British are coming!
Wednesday marks the 237th anniversary of Paul Revere's ride. Now, long before poet Henry Wadsworth Longfellow made him famous for that midnight ride, Paul Revere was better known in Boston as a silversmith and an engraver. And this week, in Providence, Rhode Island, Brown University announced they'd found one of his engravings. An archivist was cataloging an old collection of books donated to the university library more than 200 years ago. She opened one of them and out popped an old piece of paper. So she took it to Brown's rare books cataloger, Richard Noble.
And it was an engraving, not a terribly large one. And I looked down at the corner, and there was a signature P. Revere sculp. And I thought, you know, it's just crude enough to be his work.
The print was tucked inside an old medical book that had been donated by physician Solomon Drown, a member of Brown University's class of 1773.
And I looked at it further, and it seemed very genuinely to be an 18th century engraving. The paper was right, the printing method was right, everything was there.
So Noble did what researchers around the world do.
I Googled it, yes.
And he found a picture and a description of that very same print on the American Antiquarian Society website, proving, in fact, that this was a Paul Revere engraving. The print itself is rare, just one of five, but what makes it truly unique is what it depicts.
It's a depiction of the baptism of Christ.
In the print, Revere depicted Jesus in the Jordan River, along with John the Baptist, fully submerged in the water. It's unusual because that scene is normally drawn showing John the Baptist pouring water over Christ's head. And Noble says the submersion of Christ is more in tune with the Baptist telling of the baptism.
The text that's chosen for the caption, "Buried with him by baptism," is a very, very Baptist, with a capital B, text.
Paul Revere was a Unitarian, and although Richard Noble is not a religious scholar, he believes that Revere's print could hold a hidden significance, and his hope is
that somebody who knows something about that can come along and say, that's interesting, and I've never seen anything quite like it before from this period. And I think that might be the case.
That's Brown University's rare books cataloger, Richard Noble. He, alongside Brown's library staff, uncovered a new engraved print by Revolutionary War icon Paul Revere. You can see a photo of that rare Revere print at our website, npr.org. All right, we are now buried up to our necks in three-minute fiction stories. We're right in the middle of round eight of our writing contest, where we ask you to write an original short story that can be read in about 3 minutes. This round has been our largest to date. We've had over 6,000 original stories submitted. Our judge this round, the novelist Luis Alberto Urrea, is busy reading through your stories. So are we, and so are our partners at the Iowa Writers Workshop at New York University, the University of Oregon, and the University of Texas at Austin. And Luis is with us right now for a check-in. Luis, you there?
Bonjour, Giraz.
All right.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Remind everybody listening what the challenge is that you threw out for this round.
Well, the challenge is this prompt. She closed the book, placed it on the table, and finally decided to walk through the door.
And as I mentioned, more than 6,000 of our listeners sent in stories with that as the first line. And you've been reading through tons of these stories. Sort of broadly speaking, what have they done with that line? Where are they going?
It's mind-boggling what they've done. But, you know, I feel like it's like a fantasy story where a guy accidentally can hear America thinking. Mm. And I do want to cast out just one warning to the husbands of America. Y'all better shape up, because there are a whole lot of ladies killing husbands in these stories. There's a lot of dead husbands, man.
You have kindly brought three stories with you that you wanted to highlight. It's going to take, you know, several more weeks before we determine a winner, because we've got to read through these thousands of stories. But I wanted you to talk about these stories. The first one that you brought is one called Mona Lisa, Mona Lisa. Can you tell me about that story?
It's a beautiful story about mortality and aging. And what I loved about this story is that it's lyrical and dense without being corny in any way. Very emotional story.
That story, Mona Lisa, Mona Lisa, Luis, was written by Dennis Blasco of Neptune Beach, Florida. You did not know that. You don't know the identity of the writers, but I didn't want to acknowledge it if Dennis is listening. Let's go to another story that caught your attention. This one is called The Outliers.
Yeah, this is almost poetry, man. It has as a central image pressing flowers, and the flowers are also pressing memories. And what's fantastic about this story is that it makes the book not only a vector for memory and emotion, but an actual tool that makes the metaphor work.
And Luis, that story, The Outliers, was written by Jesse Rowell of Seattle. And then there's one more story that you want to bring to our attention. It's called This Time Will Be Better. It's by Cody Drabble of Sacramento, California. What drew you to that one?
It's a really touching portrait of a couple with a long history, and it's played out in a home, and the details of the carpentry in the house are just stunning, beautifully wrought, and it makes you feel like you've read a really substantial novel in 600 words. So,
well, all those stories that you mentioned, Luis, are posted at our website, npr.org/3-minute-fiction. That's 3-minute fiction, all spelled out, no spaces. You can read them right now as we speak. Luis, I'm going to let you go because you've got a lot more reading to do, man. I mean, you've got like thousands of stories to do.
Yeah, back to work.
And we'll speak to you in a couple of weeks. Thanks.
All right, Guy. Thank you.
And if you're just joining us, this is Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz, and it's time now for music. In 1987, this song by World Party launched frontman Carl Wallinger to the forefront of the modern rock scene. Other hits followed, but they ended suddenly in 2001. That's when Wallinger suffered a brain aneurysm, an aneurysm that affected his speech and vision, and he's been fighting back ever since. Wallinger started to play again a few years ago, and as a way of reintroducing himself, he's just released a unique collection. It's called Archaeology. More on that in a moment. But first, we started our conversation with that horrible period in 2001. He just left his record company on bad terms. His manager died, and then suddenly one day, he had a brain aneurysm.
Well, they say that good things come in threes, don't they? So I came out of the bedroom and said, hey, I've got a bit of a headache. And then I came out again about an hour later and just went, phone an ambulance, and then went and passed out for 24 hours. So
you were in the hospital for a month. And when you woke up, you couldn't move, you couldn't speak, right?
It was more like the brain had to be rebooted. But it was strange. I mean, I've lost my right-hand vision in either eye, so I had to sort of learn how to play things. I hold the guitar in such a way that I can't see my hand moving up and down the neck. So there was a lot of jazz chords being played for a while.
Dozing in an English garden on a sunny afternoon.
Carl, in the liner notes to this record, you write about the strange process of writing music, and I'm quoting you, what you write is, to make something real, you have to make reality disappear. What do you mean by that?
Reality is a sort of mundane thing, full of things like shopping lists and memos to yourself and tax bills and politics and all this sort of stupid stuff. And the idea is really to find the place where you forget about all those things and you have as little to do with it as possible, really. I mean, I think the best way of making music is to not really be conscious, so I try and emulate that as often as possible.
I mean, your reality, in a sense, disappeared.
Yeah.
For some time after your aneurysm. How did that affect your writing?
Well, I mean, it's a different kind of reality disappearing than an actual real version of reality disappearing medically kind of thing. It's funny, reality never really disappeared anyway, but it was like getting better after that happened, after I kind of got ill, was just part of coming back to life. Somebody, please tell me what is real.
Somebody, please tell me how I should feel. There's a song on this record called Photograph, and you write in the liner notes how it took you 17 years to... I mean, you began the song in 1994.
It was two instances, 17 years apart, actually. It wasn't... I did it way back, and I had a technical breakdown in the making of it, kind of thing, where everything became out of sync. And it was such a horrible experience that I didn't go back to it for 17 years because it was such a drag early on. And when I reconformed it for this, I was happy the way that turned out. It was plain to see, plain to see
what she could mean to me. This collection, it can't really be called a record or a retrospective because it's got old B-sides and unreleased material and live recordings and even new stuff. But it's also a picture book. It's a calendar. It's a pretty exhaustive document of your life as a songwriter. What was your goal? What did you want to do?
seen as everybody's now releasing one track to iTunes, I thought I'd put 70 tracks in the real world onto 5 CDs and make a diary to go with it, because it's my goodbye to the physical world sort of thing, you know, of making music. I just wanted to make something that was sort of against the grain, really.
I'm speaking with Carl Wallinger of the band World Party. His new 5 CD collection is called Archaeology. The collection starts off with one of your newer recordings. It's a song called Waiting Such a Long, Long Time. I've been waiting such a long, long time. And that could be taken as a little wink to the World Party fans who've waited, you know, a while.
I mean, you're on the case there. I mean, that was a sort of, I thought that was absolutely got to be the first track. World Party fans are very patient, but I just think I'd rather it has been this way. You know, having the pressure of the hit thing and all that sort of stuff, we've managed to avoid that all these years, and I'm still seem to be going, even though medically, philosophically, financially, I should be extinct, but I'm not. I've been waiting such a long time.
Now that you've sort of taken these old songs and the new songs and the unreleased songs and put them together in this collection, has it given you a chance to kind of reflect on how you've grown as a writer? I mean, you're looking at this arc. I mean, you started out in the late 70s. You were a kid, and now you're obviously a mature adult.
Yeah, well, I'm an adult. I don't know how mature I am, but I mean, I think it's just down to you to retain the energy or the ability. But I think... it's very difficult for me to say, oh, I'm going to do my best stuff next or whatever, just because I don't think it figures that if you've been doing it for years, you're getting better and better. I think it's just how you live your life and the moments that you choose to make your music. You know, see what happens. Game on.
That's Carl Wallinger. He's the man behind the band World Party. His new 5 CD collection is called Archaeology. You can hear a few tracks at our website, nprmusic.org. Carl, it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you for listening.
And it's time now for music. You're hearing pianist Alfredo Rodriguez, and if the Border Patrol in Texas had their way, you probably would never have heard this music. This is off his debut album. It's called Sounds of Space, and it was produced by Quincy Jones. Rodriguez is a 26-year-old Cuban immigrant. While playing a gig in Mexico in 2009, he made his way to Laredo, Texas to seek amnesty. There, he was arrested and on the verge of being sent back to Cuba. And I'll bring in Alfredo Rodriguez for the rest of the story. He's in our Southern California studios. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being with us. So you're under arrest in Laredo. I imagine, first of all, that you did not have many things with you. You were probably traveling very light.
Yes, it's true. I had, you know, like my music, of course, which I always try to keep it with me. So I brought my papers. And, you know, I just have like a pair of jeans and a t-shirt, so not a lot of things.
You arrive to the border and you say, I'm here to seek amnesty, and what did they say to you?
They kind of arrest me and start, you know, like asking me questions. And at the end, what they wanted to have from me was money. So I didn't have any money. As I told you, I had my another kind of paper, which was my music, and they were not really, you know, interested in that kind of paper. So after speaking 4 hours with them, they understood my situation, and they let me go at that time.
They let you go through to the U.S. border?
Through the U.S. border,
and once you were in the United States... That was it. I mean, you as a Cuban are entitled to seek amnesty.
Yes, it's true. As a Cuban, a lot of Cubans have done this like the same like I did. A lot of, you know, it's the same situation. And once you are in the United States, you are kind of safe.
Alfredo, you were a prominent jazz pianist in Cuba. Why did you want to leave Cuba? Why did you decide to come to the U.S.?
When I was back in Cuba, I was selected to be one of the 12 pianists to play at the Montroyas Festival in 2006. So I went there and I met Mr. Quincy Jones, And I had the opportunity that day to play one song for him. And after that, I was really fortunate that Quincy told me that he wanted to do something together with me, and he liked my music. So that moment kind of completely changed my, you know, kind of my life, because I knew that in order to work with Mr. Jones, I had to come here to the United States.
So from that moment in 2006, when you went to the Montreux Jazz Festival and you met Quincy Jones, up until the time you sought amnesty in the U.S. in 2009, you were sort of plotting this. You were thinking, how can I get back to see Quincy Jones?
Yes, definitely. I knew that the decision was on my side. So I decided in 2009, while I was playing a concert with my father in Mérida, Yucatán, that I had to come here to the United States. And, well, we started the conversation speaking about my crossing the border.
It seems like that experience you had at the border is told in a song on this record called Crossing the Border.
I composed the song Crossing the Border the first week when I came here to the United States. And as I always say, what I wanted to transmit with that song was my stress, was my situation, was my feelings, which is more important than notes or harmony or melody or whatever. For me, music is more about life, it's more about movement, is more about feeling, it's more about who we are. You know, sometimes music is not just coming from happiness or sadness. You know, some music is coming from, I don't know, movements or walking or crossing the border.
I'm speaking with jazz pianist Alfredo Rodriguez. His debut album is called Sounds of Space. Alfredo, as a student in Cuba, you studied primarily classical music at first.
It's true. I started at 7 years old at the Manuel Saumel Conservatory, which was very close to my house at that time. And yes, it's true what you said. I was in the last year of the university in Havana studying classical music.
I mean, when I read about that, I was amazed, because I also read that while you were studying classical music, you happened to stumble upon a Keith Jarrett CD, of course, the famed jazz pianist. Which one was it, by the way?
Was the Cone Concert.
Cone Concert, his classic one. What did you think when you first heard it?
I got very emotional, and that was a great experience for me, because in classical music, you are performing some music that was written maybe one day, maybe one month, maybe years or centuries ago. And in improvisation music, you just play whatever is coming to your mind, all the ideas that you're having. You are just creating, composing at the same time you are performing. So I couldn't do that. I couldn't do that at 14 years old when I got the CD of Keith. I knew from that moment that was what I really wanted to do in my life, which is just sit in the piano and play whatever is coming to my mind.
Quincy Jones has obviously become a mentor to you. As we mentioned, he discovered you and now works with you. You wrote a piece, actually, in his honor. And I hope I'm pronouncing it right. It's Cuba, Africa, with that. That's with a Q at the beginning. Talk about what kind of advice Quincy Jones has given you as a musician. I mean, he of course originally was a jazz composer and a trumpeter too. Presumably he had a lot of things to say to you.
Oh yeah, definitely. Not just about music. We have a great relationship, and we speak, and I learn always that I am with him about everything, you know, about his points of view, about life, about how people act. He's one of the most open-minded musicians that I know. He like all kind of music, and I am in the same page.
Is the sound of Cuba in this album?
Definitely is there. I am Cuban, and all my roots are there. Is some people, you know, some people sometimes ask me, because this is, for them, this is not like the traditional music, which of course it is not traditional music from Cuba. This is me, which is a 26 years old Cuban pianist with a different point of view, with different things to say, but definitely it's Cuban music. It's just, I don't know, my love for this bebop jazz and my love for this classical contemporary composer. Maybe my CD is, you know, like a little more contemporary, we should say. I don't know exactly, but what I really know is that this is Cuban music.
That's Alfredo Rodriguez. His debut album is called Sounds of Space. You can hear a few tracks at our website, nprmusic.org. Alfredo, what a wonderful story. Thank you so much for being with us and sharing it with us.
Thank you so much, you guys, for considering me.
For the week ending April 15th, 2012, that's the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. This week, the show was directed by Lauren Silverman and edited by Mathoni Maturi. Our production staff includes Phil Harrell, Kenya Young, Brent Bachman, Petra Mayer, Lily Percy, Amy Held, and Becky Sullivan. Lauren Beneshu is our intern. Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Guy Raz. We're back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. It's on in most places between 5 and 6 p.m. on Saturdays and Sundays. Thanks for tuning in.